What follows is a lecture that I gave yesterday at Emerson College as part of the Floating Point Series 4. And I would like to thank very much the organizers of this event, which we are the facilitators of turbulence.org and also the organizers at Emerson College. The topic of my talk is unethical capitalism and the sociable web, the affect of the exploited. I would like to use as a starting point this Herbert Marcuse quote, all liberation depends on the consciousness of servitude. I'd like to apply that to social networking and the labor that is done by the millions of people that are working in
MyFace.com, MySpace.com, it's a place to be. We the kings of MySpace, just check the friend list. I got ads for days, that shit is endless. Not a MySpace whore, I'm a MySpace pimp. My views keep rising like the Goodyear blimp. With just one click, we could be best friends. I see more news flashing than CNN. 25-8, I check the MySpace. I just can't wait to check the MySpace. 25-8, I check the MySpace. It makes life great when I check the MySpace. 25-8, I check the MySpace. It's how I get dates, I check the MySpace. 25-8, I check the MySpace. And if you ain't got a page, then get out of my face.
So I'm showing this short video clip to point to this affect that is associated with these sites, which is one of fun, of leisure, of relaxation, of dating, music, certainly a youth phenomenon. And it's while this clip comes along as somewhat with a sort of amateur aesthetics, it may be worth pointing out that it's produced at Time Warner Studios. So very, very many people produce in these places. In MySpace, you have 120 million people that created a unique profile. They are unique users. That doesn't mean that they are using this at all, but 51 million people are credited as being there basically on a daily basis or very frequently. You have 65,000 videos uploaded to YouTube every day, and I think up to a million people a day view the site. And Time magazine put out the statistic of 100 million blogs in early 2006 being in existence. So if you take this and it is quite clear and probably apparent to most of you that this is a huge phenomenon. So this affects a lot of people, and a lot of people take part in this. And yet there's a complete concentration of this traffic in 10 sites on the World Wide Web. So you have 40% of total internet page views concentrated in just 10 sites. That was in 2006. And why is that happening? It's happening because of these very many people that create content and therefore draw attention to these sites and draw in their friends and hang out with their friends in these sites. So if you look at this and you will at the statistics, you will find that in December 2006, 11.9% of people in the US that spend time online spend 11.9% of that time on MySpace. Then a while nothing, and then the next is Yahoo. So this is probably due to many things. People may log in and go have a coffee or forget that they are logged in and remember hours later. But nevertheless, this is telling us something. People spend a lot of time in these spaces, 11.9%. Over the next few years, we will experience a move of these social networking sites to the urban context. With mobile computing, ubiquitous computing, there will actually enforce this centrality. And why? Because, for instance, Facebook and MySpace both made contracts with companies such as Singular that now offer made it very easy for people to upload photos directly from their cell phone, being at a party with friends, or being in the city, or on a walk. You can upload directly to this site on the web, which will increase the centrality and the traffic on these sites even more, and of course will create even more content that makes them these sites even more rich than they are already. So what is this? Is this labor? Is this leisure? Or is it simply fun that people hang out? And young people would do this anyway. They spend time in their living rooms. They hang out with their friends in cafes or in bars. They go dancing, and they may do, put up these posts and talk to each other and upload videos and music and text to blogs, and all of this happening in the context of these social networking sites. So, and the question is this labor? And some people may strongly disagree with that, and I would very much emphasize that this is labor, and that it is, comes along, of course, very casualized, that it is labor that is very much hidden, it's very soft, it's very, it basically looks like leisure, like something that you wouldn't count as labor, and of course, in comparison to somebody working on an assembly line, it's probably not labor. But if you now take somebody like Paulo Werner, who wrote The Grammar of the Multitude, where he says that labor no longer happens solely when an object is produced. It takes on the form of a virtuosic performance, with the laborer taking on the role of a speaker. Communicative procedures often function as a means of production. Most manual labor, other than in the service industry, is moved to the global south. So you have labor taking on a completely different character, which is, like Werner says, more like a performance, like a speaker. And what is happening in spaces of the sociable web is, of course, that people become speakers, right? This is the great thing about it, and Gerd Loving pointed this out with his argument of the democratizing effect of the blogosphere, not necessarily simply because people, individuals, can do this, now they can speak, but because of the mass of people that can do this, and the mass of people that now can experience themselves as speakers. And arguably, or possibly, this will translate into a more participatory politics.
In Madrid a couple of minutes ago on TV, I saw that Google is interested in
mix of videos, because these are some of the, you could say, rock star videos on YouTube, at least the top two. The treadmill video with 10 million views, and the Chinese Backstreet Boys with 1,335,000 views. So there's a lot of attention generated through this creative labor that wouldn't necessarily be of value if people wouldn't have it on their laptops, for instance. But now that they upload it, it creates this value that also translates into monetary value by the accompanying advertisements on YouTube. So it's not that the video directly generates money, but like all over the web, the logic is that you have you draw attention to a site, so you have the eyeballs, and then this attention economy translates into financial gain. But this is, I'm also showing, because really to emphasize the positive aspect, on the one hand, of the sociable web, which is really that more and more people can experience themselves as speakers. you have Amazon.com, she's shopping at it, and you have this phenomenon of people reviewing books on Amazon for free. They don't get paid for this. And then you have people like Harriet Klausner, who reviewed some 13,000 books on Amazon. She was not paid. Just imagine the time and the labor that it takes to write that much. And what does she get out of it is, of course, a very complex kind of negotiation or a complex transaction. It's not that she is slaving away and doesn't get anything out of it. She gets arguably some micro fame out of it. She, you know, is part of this, belongs to this community of Amazon reviewers, and she has a public that she has a platform for her writing. This is all good, but nevertheless, in the end of the day, this practice that she does for free is still contributing massively to the, you know, financial gain of Amazon.com. So what happens is that the very, very many create financial gain for the very, very few. And you may immediately say, well, wait a minute, YouTube just announced that they will share the advertisement profits from their site with their users, with those users that upload creative original content. But here you could immediately counter that it remains to be seen how much this will actually be and what the relationship will be about what is handed out and how symbolical that is, or symbolic in the sense of really not a real relationship between these 10 million page views of this treadmill video and the money it actually generated for the company. So community becomes a business. Community becomes a commodity, you could say. And this is, I'm singling out here probably the very only thing that I disagree with Yochai Benkler, and otherwise his fantastic book, The Wealth of Networks, I'm very much enjoying. So, but he says there that the key is managing the marriage of money and non-money without making non-money feel like a sucker. And I would quite strongly disagree with that, actually, and say that we should rather create an awareness of this dynamic and you know, tell people and advocate this position that, yes, people enjoy being useful and they do create monetary value, but this is really perverted by the market system. So this is not something that we should just make people feel good about, but in fact we should point this out over and over again. So I'll be going off to the next video.
Hi YouTube, this is Chad and Steve. We're the co-founders of the site, and we just want to say thank you. Today we have some exciting news for you. We've been acquired by Google.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to every one of you guys that have been contributing to YouTube, the community. We wouldn't be anywhere close to where we are without the help of this community. Thanks a lot.
We're going to stay committed to developing the best service for you. Developing the most innovative service and tools and technologies so you can keep having fun on our site.
The most compelling part of this is being able to really concentrate on features and functionality for the community. We've certainly been listening to the problems that have been coming in, surfacing on the customer service as well as the developer front, and we're definitely keen on just reorganizing all of our efforts and energy back into building out the community and resolving these problems that you guys have been having.
And this is great. Two kings have gotten together, and we're going to be able to provide you an even better service and build even more innovative features for you.
I don't know. Just keep going.
Two kings. What does it mean for the user community?
Get your hand off me. Kings.
Two kings have gotten together. The king of search, the king of video, have gotten together. We're gonna have it our way.
Bye, YouTube.
So here you see the two co-founders of YouTube, and shortly after their buyout by Google for actually $1.8 billion, and so, you know, these kids aren't evil, right? That's certainly not what I'm trying to say. Just, you know, listen to this. Right? Thanks to all of you guys who've been contributing to YouTube, to the community. We wouldn't be anywhere close to where we are without the help of this community. Thanks a lot. So that, of course, is true, because if you see, compare the service that Google Video offered in comparison to YouTube, very similar services, but YouTube was just the cooler interface, and that maybe is really the term here. It's you know, a cooler way of uploading video. If you compare archive.org to YouTube, this becomes even more apparent. And of course, this kind of coolness factor can also wear down when now, for instance, YouTube plans to introduce digital rights management, where they want to cross-check clips that you upload against a database of audio of films produced in Hollywood, and then reject those where there is a match, so that soundtracks can't be used and so on. So what we are seeing is really an individual, what I would call an individualistic collectivism. The majority of net publics aren't motivated really by what Peter Kropotkin, this Russian anarchist, would call mutual aid, but they seek fame, right? They want, on one hand, to aid the common good, and on the other, also is massive self-interest involved here. So if you look at something like Delicious, for instance, I'm using this very fervently, pretty much every day, and on one hand, I'm doing this to prepare my classes, very much to organize my own bookmarks, and on the other hand, it also contributes to communal value. So you have both, right? It's self-interest, and then also contributing to a larger communal good. It's intermixed, individualistic collectivism. In another context, I created these two charts that I will show you here, two illustrations that show you some activities in concentric order here. So moving towards the middle, it becomes more intensive. And towards the periphery, you have more, maybe more silent participation, you could say. So people subscribe, read, forward, link, favorite, and tag. And maybe more intensely, intense ways of participation in the social web would be if you actually collaborate, moderate, remix, comment, write, and share. Now you can look at the set of motivations that one could probably talk for several hours about, all these aspects here that I bring together. But let's say just one would be hormones that drive people to participate in MySpace, right? Or you have a strong need for group belonging, or you join LinkedIn to get a job, or you just have the pleasure of creation. You seek friendship, you would actually like to contribute to the greater good, and all, as Yochai Benkler says, you know, agonistic giving, I give because I'm great. And so all of these things kind of contribute to as motivating factors for people. I'm not going to go much further into this at this point. One example that in some way illustrates quite well what I'm criticizing here is basically this site, Yads, which was launched recently at Le Web 3 in Paris. And the slogan here, as you can see, is video advertising by the people who watch it. So if you are really liking your Reebok sneaker, you can shoot your own video animation aimed at yourself, advertising this very sneaker, and send it to this company, and they will try to sell it to Reebok and rake in the profit, surely sharing some of it with you. In a similar way, and I want to be very clear here about the ambiguity, because this artwork, I like it very much. It's Learning to Love You More. And what is done here, however, is still that the artist who created it, Miranda July, is still, she solicits these assignments here and solicits contribution to the site based on these assignments. And this is great. And then these things, these artworks, like you see these photos here, for instance, are shown in a gallery or in a museum. Of course, with, you know, this person will be credited, the person like you see here, Jennifer Hill, Omaha. But in the end of the day, it is still predominantly Miranda July who rakes in the cultural capital, the social capital of this project. And so there is this, you know, she is a cultural context provider for this platform, and there's certainly this dynamic that what she initiated is clearly under her heading, you could say. So she is really credited for it, most of all. In October 2006, Lawrence Lessig posted to his blog an entry called The Ethics of Web 2.0. And while this term may be a little misleading, or I don't really think that he talks about ethics, but he makes an interesting distinction. He talks about fake sharing sites, and he lists YouTube, versus true sharing sites like Flickr or Blip TV. So the difference being, on Flickr you can just go take the, and download the photo to your desktop. On Blip TV, the system of Blip TV is designed to share video in a way that you upload it and another person can just take it. Well, this is possible with YouTube now as well. If you have plugins in Firefox, you can easily just you know, if you have an extension called Video Downloader in Firefox, for example, you can download the videos also on YouTube. But the system itself, YouTube itself, does not encourage this. In fact, doesn't really make it, it's not built into their system. So Lessig calls this a fake sharing site and associates it with an unethical behavior to an extent. And says that true sharing would be on Flickr and Blip. And with that point, I certainly agree. And so there is an... But let's look really at this question of ethics. Like, one of the key guidelines for ethics is to follow an action that does the least harm and provides the most good. So if we take this to social web media, we should at least first acknowledge, on one hand, that it does a lot of good in the sense of that it makes contributes to the democratization of society by, like I said before, giving people the experience of being a speaker. Right? So, yeah, 51 million people in MySpace and 100 million blogs should speak for themselves. But who really benefits from the value that's created in these online actions? And these actions include if you give information about yourself, but also the choices you make, the way you navigate, you know, what you, the choices you make or don't make, where you direct your attention, the ratings you assign, and of course the content that you recommend to others, and also the content you upload yourself. So your attention itself, your eyeball, in a sense, creates a value. And that is financial value. So where do the problems start? If you want to think, so we just looked at the good, and if you want to start looking at the bad, let's say the harm that is done, or the problems, let's just start here with problems, in this case with Facebook, you see that these social architectures have, of course, an ethics of code. The architectures of participation are by no means neutral. So you have here, for example, MySpace that is showing male and female profiles. This is a choice that you have. While my experience, and this we are talking about the university community here, from my experience in the universities that I taught in, I frequently enrolled Peter, who would become Kathy halfway through the semester. So you have this transgender experience that I think is quite strong in a contemporary youth. which this really doesn't account for. And I wonder how people who self-identify as transgender, how they deal with that in this environment. Another factor also on the the dark side of sociable web media is that this concentration with which I started out. So if you look at breakdowns of Delicious or of Google Calendar, these breakdowns become quite tragic, or they become quite consequential, because we have our lives in them, right? So this is really a monoculture that is created. People, I do not have the statistics for that, but I would assume that most people really upload to Flickr. So there isn't really a diversification of where people take their holiday photographs. And so just look at this comment here from Google Calendar. You know, oops, cross your fingers and try again in a few minutes. We are sorry for the inconvenience. So, well, I woke up and had my cup of coffee in the morning and wanted to leave the house and literally didn't know where to go, because this lasted for about an hour. Imagine it would really matter where I have to go, and then, you know, if I would be a medical doctor, so where it would really matter, then these things become really highly problematic. Or Flickr. Always is very casual language in their moments of disaster. Or here, the much bemoaned switch from the old school account holder at Flickr to the Yahoo ID that's now required. So my point in this section is that I think that this reliance on very few central sites, call them rockstar sites or high traffic sites, is highly problematic, because it does create this monoculture that if these sites, which are all proprietary, right, decide to make decisions that are unfavorable to you, you have already invested all your, let's say, holiday memories into them. Or sometimes, you know, I have to look up on Amazon what my old address was, because they actually remember, but I don't remember. So there's a harm done. The harm is, of course, time. This is all, of course, complex, and I don't want to paint a one-sided picture here, but I would again reassert this claim, or this maybe provocation, that there is an exploitation taking place, an exploitation of labor that really doesn't look like it at all. It looks everything but that. And you have also ecological sustainability. So in Avatar today, in Second Life, is basically eats up the same amount of bandwidth, electricity, as a real life person in Brazil. So these things are actually ecologically quite harmful, this particular 3D virtual world. The attention is another issue. Continuous partial attention, in the Stone's term, is an issue, because people, especially now if you think of these services going mobile, are really challenging people's attention. So, you know, who is really paying attention to you in a conversation and not to some screen at the same time, or some other texting input, or some iPod in their ear. So this is really contributing to that. Social architectures, I mentioned this example of Facebook, mentioned this trusting of proprietary platforms with our memories. You could also say we trust our sociality to deeply proprietary places, environments, contexts, platforms. The next thing that I haven't really talked about yet so far is the stifling of design creativity through blogware in general, but also through MySpace in particular, because the options that are given are really just like the choice between Coke and Pepsi. And if you remember the early days of the internet and the many sort of utterly bizarre and, you know, experimentation with HTML and websites, you saw that there was much more diversity of design. There wasn't this slick kind of block, sterile design, but there were a lot of sites were broken, and this had all its own charm. But it was certainly very diverse, where now we really have more, also there, a design monoculture. And as I mentioned many times before, these net publics generate content for free, and it is on proprietary grounds. So the what are possibilities in all this? What I cannot offer is some grand solution. I do not believe in a revolution. I do not believe in the possibility of radical social change within the U.S. Right now. I think I don't. In with radical social change, I mean revolution that indeed some people suggest. So where is there? Where? What can one do? If one thinks of oneself, if you self-identify, let's say, as an activist, what do you do with these environments? How can you critically position yourself? And I think a starting point is not so different, like with many other media before, is, well, for one, to realize that these structures are actually the structures of the internet and of the social web in particular are really not all that different than what's happening in the what people call the real life world. That sort of real existing capitalism is really as present there as it is at work. So these 10 sites that I talked about in the beginning stand for a certain business elite. They stand for particular capitalist values. And to create an awareness of our embrace, and I don't at all exclude myself from that. I think I realize also how easy it is to, the enemy is also within me, if you want to talk of an enemy. The manager within us is something to certainly to look at, and to look at how these market-based behaviors have really penetrated us. How this is naturalized, how servitude is naturalized, how we don't ask to, we just take our tray and in the fast food restaurant and bring it to the trash. Who would have thought of that before? American fast food companies came up with that idea of moving labor to the customers. So we can make alternative choices, and the things that I can come up with right now are, for instance, to say that we should fight these monocultures, not in the sense of not using Google, not in the sense of not using YouTube, but to really make use of them in a way that is deeply in our own interest. And to also use parallel sites like Craigslist or Archive.org, which are both non-profit. Craig Newmark has many times refused to be bought out, for instance. So this is a kind of fortress of foundation that has not gone this way. And then in terms of software, you can install these FLAS applications, again, also in parallel to your proprietary software. To come to an end and somewhat seek, I make this attempt to come to a conclusion and see where we can, where I want to go with this, or where what I want to suggest, which direction, which possibilities I want to open up. And let's just think of Ulysses, Homer. And Ulysses traveled the waters and passed by this island of which famously was filled with these sirens, these very seductive creatures that would sing and have this the siren song would somewhat magically draw these seamen, these sailors, to this island, who would then sink with their ships and die on the stones of the island on the shore. And the only chance for somebody to survive this was to listen and not fall prey to it. So what Ulysses did, and I'm sure you know this, but I'm just saying it once more, he tied himself, he made his man tie himself to the mast, and they would pluck their ears so that they would not hear it, but Ulysses could hear it and could resist because he was physically not able to change course. In which case, the sirens would turn into stone and die. So take that to Amazon.com. I don't know. In a way, you could say that Amazon is, and much of the sociable web, puts out this siren song that wants to lure you into their site, into their net, to simply your presence on their site is enough to contribute to their gain. So how can this be in any way undermined or, you say, re-engineered against the intentions of the creators? Well, one example is Kevin Killian, perhaps, who is a poet from San Francisco, who is an Amazon reviewer. And he wrote 1,525 reviews for Amazon. And they aren't really reviews. So what he does is he writes autobiographical fiction in the form of reviews. So he would take this piece of jewelry that you see here and say, oh, this is just like the piece of jewelry that was in this oil painting in my mother's house. And so it reminds me of that and the smell of the room and so on. So it's his autobiographical, it's fiction, it's his work. And this allows him to, because it is all just related to his life, allows him to review anything from sweet potato baby food to Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago. And he has an audience on Amazon. He doesn't really review these things, truly. And so it's in a way a hack of Amazon. It's an artistic practice, maybe even a genre, that opens up. Could also draw this parallel to MySpace hack. So maybe this is a hopeful example of a practice that situates itself within these proprietary spaces and makes them somewhat hybrid. So here's a cultural, maybe even alternative practice that situates itself on this proprietary ground. So what I would argue is that for the next decade or so, we really need a skill set for participatory cultures. We really need to know how to navigate these spaces. And we need to have this self-awareness, this will to be in sync with our own stated values and ideals. In the sense that we need to learn to switch off, to not pay attention, to be focused and really have our own interest at heart and the interest of our community, and to be aware that this distributed creativity and this distributed labor is also creating massive revenue for the very, very few. So the exploitation that's taking place here is nothing new, of course. This is just capitalism, good old capitalism. But what is different is the mass. So you could say this the massive amount of people that simply gives away their labor for free and does it without even recognizing it as labor. It actually recognizing it as something they would really want to do anyway. They realize it as something that is pleasurable and fun and creative. And so here think of Wirner again, who talks of labor as a performative act, as something that is actually related to being a speaker. So there's this another fact that I mentioned, which is related to decentralization, and I talked about this several times. So these are a few directions and possibilities that I can come up with. This is really something that should rather open up a discussion than in any way conclude this debate. So I hope that this will instigate for you a discussion of how we can navigate these structures in a critical way, how to develop a criticality, to develop a way that embraces these structures to an extent, but also navigates in our own interests and in sync with our own values. Thanks very much.